Lecture S-28, February 4th, 1963, Electromagnetic Mass. Lecture S-28, February 4th, 1963, Electromagnetic Mass. Lecture S-28, February 4th, 1963, Electromagnetic Mass.
Particularly to the behavior of matter. However, this great edifice, which is such a beautiful success in explaining so many phenomena, falls on its face, ultimately. When one follows all of our physics too far, we always get into some kind of trouble. And today I want to discuss the trouble, the failure of the classical electromagnetic theory. As you undoubtedly appreciate, there's a failure of all of classical physics because of the quantum mechanics. But the classical physics is a mathematically consistent picture, although it doesn't agree with experience. But the interesting thing is that the classical theory of electromagnetism is an unsatisfactory theory all by itself. There are difficulties associated with the ideas of Maxwell theory, which are not solved or not directly associated with the quantum mechanics. You say, but maybe it's no use worrying about these difficulties because the quantum mechanics is going to change the laws of electrodynamics, and we should ask more what the difficulties look like, of course, after the modification. But you don't know how to make that modification yet. And furthermore, the difficulties remain. Therefore, it doesn't waste too much of our time to tell what those difficulties are. Secondly, it's of a great and interesting historical point. Furthermore, you probably will get some kind of feeling of accomplishment if we have carried a theory far enough to see everything, including all its troubles, instead of all its successes. This difficulty is associated with the concept of electromagnetic mass, momentum, energy, and so forth, associated with the electron or with any point charge or charged particle. The concept of charged particles, simple charged particles, and the electromagnetic field are kind of inconsistent. Of course, with enough strain and stress, you can usually straighten something out, but only in a most artificial way. So let me describe the difficulty. We can begin by making some exercises with our energy and momentum concepts. And I have here two. One which, in fact, we did before, which is the energy of a charge. Let me suppose, to make a simple model of an electron, that all of its charge, Q, is on the surface of a sphere of radius A. Of course, it might be distributed some other way. Or you might like to have it as a point charge, in which case you just take A equals zero. Now let's calculate the energy that's in the electromagnetic field. If the charge is standing still, there's no magnetic field, then the energy per unit volume is proportional to the square of the field, but the field varies inversely as the square of the distance, so the energy density varies inversely as the fourth power of the distance. Then we must take the total energy, must integrate the inverse fourth power of R over the volume of space. And the volume of space is proportional to R squared times the radius interval times 1 over R fourth. Then that's the integral that we have to do to calculate the total energy in the field, multiplied by complicated constants, which are correctly written over here. Now, this is the integral of dr over R squared, which is easy to integrate. It's 1 over R when integrated, and it's only necessary to put the limits in. One limit is infinity, and if you like point charges, the other limit is zero, and there's the great difficulty. Because 1 over R at zero is infinite, or the energy density, if the field varies as inversely as the square of the distance, is rising so rapidly near the origin, inversely as the fourth power, that the volume integral of it is infinite. There's an infinite amount of energy surrounding a point charge. What's wrong with an infinite energy? So you can't get the energy away, you can't get the energy out, unless you can make the charge disappear or something. So it's just, is there any real difficulty produced by this? I mean, a thing that comes out infinite is annoying. But the question is whether it has any direct physical effects. And then, for that purpose, we must turn to something else than just the energy. Because we would like to know how the energy, say, changes when we move the charge or something like that. And then if the amount changes are infinite, then we'll be in trouble. Incidentally, if we instead suppose that the charge is on a sphere of radius A, which I will use for to hold the difficulty away for a while, then the numerical value is inversely as A. The lower limit then is A. And when I reinstate all these coefficients, I get this combination here. And with the usual notation that's conventional, the charge on the electron squared over 4 pi epsilon naught is often called E squared, and I write the formula as 1 half E squared over A. Well, let's leave that one there, and let's ask another question. Suppose a charge is moving at a uniform velocity through space, an electron is moving, and for a moment, let's take the case that the velocity is low compared to the speed of light. I would like to show you a most remarkable thing, that associated with this electron moving through space, there's momentum. Oh, yeah, I know, because the particle has a mass. No, even if the particle didn't have a mass, there would be a momentum. That's sort of backwards. You might define the mass by the momentum, but let me try to distinguish. Well, let's just see that in the electromagnetic field, when a charge is moving, there's momentum. And that momentum is directed in the direction of the total momentum is directed in the direction of motion and is, for small velocities, proportional to the velocity. When a charge is moving with velocity in a certain direction, the magnetic field in the space is V cross the electric field over C squared, as we have seen before. So that there's a magnetic field coming out this way and going in here, or vice versa. I have been commented that I should always get my signs right. I refuse. I cannot. I just cannot train myself to think right, and I have the signs perhaps incorrectly. But the net result, by golly, is that the momentum is in this direction when you're all finished. Now, there's a magnetic field in this out or in, let's say out, and an electric field this way. And so if you take the cross product to find the momentum vector is in this direction here, and if you chase it out, it's in this direction here. In this direction here, in this direction here, a kind of a thing, momentum. The transverse components of this momentum all add up to zero when you integrate over all space, because there's incoming momentum here and upgoing momentum here and downcoming momentum here. It averages out. But the component in the direction of the velocity does not average out. So let us take the component in the x direction of E cross B, where B is V cross E. If theta is this angle, then since the velocity is in the direction of x, and the electric field is in this direction, B is equal to V times E times sine theta. And then if I take the component of the cross product, the S, the momentum, in the direction of motion, I have another sine theta. So by the time I get this thing straightened out, I have a V and a C squared, and proportional E squared and sine squared theta over the volume. The integral over a volume in four dimensions, let's say of sine squared theta just for a minute, is R squared dr d phi d sine theta d theta. For solid angle integrations, I suppose you know. It's always easier to use this as d of cosine theta. And the integral of d phi in our problem is 2 pi. And d cosine theta times sine squared is 1 minus cosine squared theta. And then it's easy to integrate. You get cosine minus cosine cubed over 3 between the limits of 0 and pi, and so on. It's easy to show that the average of sine squared theta over a sphere, it's not like the average of sine squared theta over theta, but the average of sine squared theta over the averaging function sine theta d theta is 2/3. So this is 2/3. And then E squared, as before, varies inversely as the fourth power of the distance. And the final pi, after integrating the angles, the final integral is again the integral of 1 over r fourth times r squared dr, which we will integrate only outside because there's no fields inside this uniform spherical distribution of charge on a shell. And so we find when we chase it down that the total integral is 2/3 E squared over A, where A is the radius that we chose, times C squared, or multiplied by the velocity V. Or in other words, the momentum in the field, the electromagnetic momentum, is proportional to the velocity,
And if I get the signs right, it's with a positive coefficient, 2/3, e squared over ac squared. Where does mass come from? In the beginning of our laws of mechanics, we supposed that there was such a thing as mass. We supposed that there was such a thing as mass, that an object carried a momentum proportional to its velocity. And now we discover that it's understandable that a thing carries a momentum proportional to its velocity. It might, in fact, be that the mass is just this effect of electrodynamics. The origin of mass has previously been unknown, and at last we have in the theory of electrodynamics a grand opportunity to understand something that was never understood before that came from the blue. This time it comes from Maxwell. And that is mass. You see, here's a momentum proportional velocity due to electromagnetic influences. If we're conservative for a moment, let's say there are two kinds of masses. That, in fact, the total momentum of an object would be the mechanical momentum plus this new piece, the electromagnetic momentum. And that the mechanical momentum is the mass that's mechanical times V plus this term, which if we could call this coefficient M sub electrical just for the fun of it, this would be M sub electrical times V. Of course, in experiments where we measure the mass of a particle by seeing how much momentum it has, how it swings around in an orbit and so on and so on, we're measuring the total mass. We say, generally, the momentum is the total mass times the velocity. But we now understand that the mass that's observed can be as two pieces or more. But at least we know of two pieces, a mechanical piece plus an electromagnetic piece. And what I'm trying to say is a thrilling possibility exists that the mechanical piece is not there at all, and it's all electromagnetic. But be it as it may, there's at least definitely an electromagnetic piece, and we have a formula for it. It's an interesting question to find out what size the electron would have to be if there were no mechanical mass. In which case, I need only set this expression here exactly equal to the mass of the electron. The answer comes out this way. A, it says, would have to be 2/3 of e squared over mc squared. This particular combination, e squared over mc squared, where this is the total mass observed of the electron, has been called the classical electron radius, r naught, and has, when you put the constants in, the numerical value 2.82 times 10 to the minus 13 centimeters, about 1/100,000th of the diameter of an atom. You say, why is this called the classical electron radius? Why don't you call 2/3 of this the classical electron radius? The answer is that if you do this calculation with other distributions of charge, for instance, that the charge is uniformly distributed throughout the volume of the sphere, then the 2/3 changes, I believe, to 3/5 in that case. Perhaps I'm wrong. I don't remember. At any rate, the coefficients change depending upon the distribution. And rather than to get into a debate, they decided to define this as the unit, and then different theories would have different amounts of this, like 2/3 of it or 3/5 of it, depending upon the distribution that was chosen by the person in question. Well, let's see if this is a possible theory. First, I calculated this for low velocity. If we calculate it for higher velocity, then comes a certain amount of confusion, but it's not hard if you are as smart as Lorentz and realize that this is contracted and that the fields have changed in accordance with formulas that we derived before. Even you now can calculate this thing for a moving charge with arbitrary velocity, and you will discover that this formula is altered by a factor 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. In other words, the electromagnetic mass rises with velocity inversely as the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, a discovery that was made before the theory of relativity. In fact, early experiments were proposed to measure the rate of the changes in the observed mass of a particle with velocity in order to determine how much of the mass was mechanical and how much was electrical, because it was believed that the electrical part would vary with velocity, and at that time it was supposed that the mechanical part would not. Of course, while the experiments were being done, the theorists were also working, and finally that the theory of relativity was developed, in which it was proposed that no matter what the origin of mass, they all must go as 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. So this, but this was the beginning of understanding of the reasons, or not the reasons so much, but the beginning of the theory that mass depended on velocity. Now, let's consider further the question as to whether the mass can all be electromagnetic. I didn't mean to push this up. This will come later. I meant to look at this. The next thing I'm going to calculate is the energy in the field. We did it before, and here it is. Now we'll suppose a theory of relativity, because, as a matter of fact, it was the history of these difficulties from which the theory of relativity evolved. And rather than drag you through the type of reasoning, the confused reasoning that existed before, we'll immediately see the difficulties from a present point of view. And that is this. If this is the energy in the field, since energy and mass have to be related, there will be a mass in the field, which would be the energy in the field, the subelectric means in the electromagnetic field, divided by c squared, and therefore the mass electromagnetic should be 1/2 e squared over c squared a. Note it isn't the same coefficient as over here. This time we got a different formula of a mass, which is 4/3 of 2/3 of e squared over c squared a. In fact, you'll find in the old literature the formula E equals 4/3 mc squared, and here and there, before you'll discover the formula E equals mc squared, because this was discovered first, and it was wrong, and they got all balled up on account of it. But anyway, that got straightened out. But at the same time, the fact that the mass of the electron calculated from energy doesn't agree with the mass calculated from momentum is a very annoying thing. It's especially annoying after we carefully proved that the theory of electrodynamics is consistent with the principle of relativity. And we also show that the only way the theory of relativity could be right was that energy and mass, momentum and energy makes a four vector, which implies without question that the energy has to come out to be the same as that the momentum has to come out to be the same as the energy times the velocity. So we have some kind of a trouble. We made a mistake. We didn't make a mistake. We just disregarded something. In all the equations for energy and momentum and all that, we assumed the conservation laws. That is, we assumed that all the forces were balanced and that the works done and the momentum carried by other machinery was also to be included. Now, if we had a sphere of charge with positive charge, all negative, because it's an electron, negative charge, for instance, all around, that would result in forces which would tend to blow the thing apart. This is a system with unbalanced forces, and when we have unbalanced forces, you get all kinds of errors in the laws relating energy and momentum. It is necessary to imagine, for consistency, that something holds this together, that there is some kind of rubber band. Well, you don't like that. When the notes are being made, they always change my words from the inelegant to the elegant, then they will be called Poincaré stresses. Poincaré stresses are required to hold the electron together. In other words, something's necessary to hold the electron together, as was pointed out by Poincaré. If you include the energy and momentum associated with the stress system, which holds the force system, the rubber bands, if you want, which holds the electron together, then these numbers are modified in a way that depends upon the stresses and the way you pick them out. All the numbers are changed. But one thing is good, and that is that the coefficient that comes out from the momentum calculation is the same as the number that comes out from the energy calculation of the mass. However, both of those numbers contain two contributions, one the electromagnetic energy and the other the stresses, the Poincaré stress momentum and energy. When they're added together do you get a consistent theory, and therefore it is impossible at this level, in this form, to get all the mass to be electromagnetic. In other words, it is not a legal theory to have nothing but electrodynamics. Something else has to be added. You can call them rubber bands or Poincaré stresses or something, but there would have to be other forces in nature to make a consistent theory at this level. Obviously, as soon as we start to put forces on the inside of the electron, the beauty of the whole idea begins to disintegrate.
Because it gets complicated. You want to then know how strong are the stresses, how does the electron shake, does it oscillate, what does it do, all the internal properties of the electron, and so on. Now, it might be possible the electron does have such internal properties, but no one has made a good theory of the electron, and the only thing one does is predict odd properties like modes of oscillation of the whole ball, the jelly, and so on, which haven't apparently been observed. I say this apparently because we observe a lot of things that we don't understand, and we may someday find out that one of those things that we didn't understand was, in fact, the oscillations of the Poincaré stresses. I doubt it, but I cannot say for sure anything when I don't know everything. Since I admit at this late date that I don't know everything, and I cannot therefore say anything accurately. However, the complex structure implied by this theory is not desirable. The theory led to a blind alley. In other words, the attempt to make all the mass electromagnetic led to a blind alley in this particular direction because of the complexities that are induced. Now I would like to discuss, though, how it might be possible to modify this. Many is the attempt to modify the electrodynamics theory of Maxwell so that the idea that that the electron as a simple point charge could be maintained. And some of the theories even were able to make it so that all the mass was electromagnetic and so forth. But I would like to discuss now some of the possibilities that have been suggested, all of which have died. However, it's interesting to see the struggles of the human mind. Yeah? Okay, so we talk about some of them. In the first place, we would like to understand why, if the momentum in the field is proportional to the velocity, that we say we have a mass. It's easy. It's the coefficient between momentum and velocity. But after all, another way of speaking, just to understand it better, the mass can be thought of as this, that when you try to accelerate a charge, you need to make a force. And so we ought to look at the thing, just for the sake of discussion, a little more closely and find out where the force comes from. How do I know there has to be a force from this formula? That's easy. I proved all the conservation of momentum laws. I got that all straightened out. And I find the following. I have the particle. Now I push on it for a while, and then I look at it again, and there's momentum in the electromagnetic field. Momentum must have been poured into the field somehow. Therefore, there must have been a force pushing the electron in order to get it going, a force in addition to the force due to its own inertia, a force due to its electromagnetic interactions. And from where does the force arrive? And the picture is something like this. Here's the charge. And this piece of charge acts on this piece of charge to produce equal and opposite forces. So there are forces on all of the pieces of charge, but they balance out exactly. However, if the particle is being accelerated, because of the fact that the electromagnetic influences take a time to go from one place to another, the force that this exerts on this one depends upon where this used to be, if I may say so, and is somewhat differently directed. While the force that's on this one, due to this one, depends upon where this one used to be. And the force is again in a different direction. And when you add it all together, it doesn't cancel out. It does for uniform velocity. My argument is a little bit superficial because you would first think at a uniform velocity even, there would be an error. But it turns out you have to go to a more complicated motion of an acceleration before there is a net force. That is, action and reaction are not exactly equal unless you include everything in the electromagnetic field. And if we just look at the action of one piece of charge on the other, the thing holds itself back by its own bootstraps. And it is possible, but very difficult, to calculate this force. This force against the motion. If x is the position of the particle as a function of time, it's been found out, the calculation is quite elaborate, it's much easier to do this momentum analysis, but the force that results depends on the motion of the particle, and one can make a series by supposing that the motion is relatively uncomplicated, and the first term in the series depends upon the acceleration of the particle.
and it's proportional to x double dot. Now, if you go to a still higher correction involving the deviations in a still higher order, then you get a term that looks like this, x triple dot, the rate of change of the acceleration. And then there's a number whose coefficient I don't remember, but whatever it is by dimensions, I argue. Anyway, it comes out like this, x four dots, et cetera. And so there is a term proportional to the acceleration, which varies inversely as the radius of the electron A and represents the force, and this number comes out exactly the same as this one for very good reasons. That should be. If the charge distribution is chosen to be different, so that this number is changed, I think, to 3/5, maybe it's 3/10, let's say 3/5, this is also changed, of course, in the same way. This number here is not changed, it so happens, it's exactly the same. This number, whatever it is changed too. You'll notice that the radius depends, this term we could call the electromagnetic mass, and then these are corrections. That is, if the electron has infinitesimal radius, then this would be infinitesimal as the limit goes to zero, but this would still be there, although this would have gone to infinity. Now we see where the force arises. It arises from the force of one part of the electron on itself. And the infinity arises because we allow such a silly thing, perhaps a silly thing, that the electron acts on itself. In the beginning of the theory of electricity, we talked about the interaction of one charge and the other, and we tried to make a theory of these interacting charges, and we end up with a field theory, and then we believe it so much that we allow it to tell us about the force of one part of an electron on another. Perhaps the entire difficulty is that electrons do not act on themselves, that the theory has been extrapolated too far from the interaction of various electrons to the idea that electron interacts on itself. So many possibilities have been suggested in which we disregard the possibility that an electron acts on itself. Then, if we take that out, we will have the great advantage, or disadvantage anyway, we don't have the infinity anymore due to the self-action. We don't have electromagnetic momentum associated with the particle or electromagnetic mass associated with the particle. That all the mass is back to being mechanical, but there are no difficulties in the theory. I must say immediately that this theory requires a modification of the idea of the electromagnetic field. You remember the idea was that you can calculate only two numbers, E and B, at any point from all of the effects of all the other charges, and only the E and B calculated there is required to know what happens next. This isn't exactly right now, because if you have an electron in a certain place, it isn't the net E and B that acts, but it's only that piece of E and B which is due to the other electron. So you have to keep track always of how much of the E and B is due to your own charge and how much is due to the other charges, which makes the theory much more elaborate, but it gets rid of a difficulty, does it not? And so we can throw away this whole set of forces. There's no such a thing as the electron acting on itself. However, we have thrown away the baby with the bath. See? Because it turns out that this term in the force is needed. That this term in the force does something very definite, and if you throw it away, you're cooked. And here's what it is. When we accelerate a charge, it radiates energy. So a charge moving with accelerations, an object which is accelerated, I just said it, loses energy. Therefore, to accelerate a charge, to shake it back and forth, must require an additional force than to shake a neutral object back and forth. Because otherwise you can't account for the loss of energy. You must be doing some extra work in shaking a charged particle. We've talked about this already. It's the radiation resistance. The rate at which we must do work by a force which oscillates the charge must be equal to the rate of loss of energy, rate of radiation of energy per second. Incidentally, we worked this out some time ago, and that's 2/3 E squared times the acceleration of the charge squared. So the question is this: if when we move accelerate a charge, we have to have more force than if we accelerate a neutral object, from where does the force arise? If it's a big antenna, it's the action of one part of the antenna current on the other.
But if it's one stinky little electron, there's only one place it could arise from, and that's the action of one part of the electron on the other. As a matter of fact, if I calculate the rate at which work is being done by these bootstrap forces, I find, of course, that that should be the force times the velocity. Of course, you know by this time that's the rate at which work is done by a force. And this term here is just the rate of change of the kinetic energy or electromagnetic kinetic energy. But this is the interesting one. This term will produce, for the rate of work, a term minus 2/3 E squared over C cubed times X triple dot. And you say, yeah, it checks with almost. It should equal this. It doesn't. This is right. This is wrong. But it doesn't make any, as I'll show you in a minute. It's 2/3 E squared over C cubed times the rate of change with time of X dot X double dot plus 2/3 E squared over C cubed times X double dot squared. This is just an equal thing with algebra
to make it equal, to show you that the two effects are the same. This we obtain for the average rate of radiation of a charge in cyclic motions and so on. We could never say exactly when their energy was radiated. So if we average this over any reasonable length of time, we average here the derivative of something. So if it's a cyclic motion, this something comes back to its original value, and the integral of it over the cycle is nothing. But this thing, the average of this over cyclic motions is the same as the average of this over cyclic motions, so it works. In other words, this is the formula for the force of radiation resistance, the force which is required in order to account for the conservation of energy when a charge, when an accelerating electron radiates. And it is therefore impossible to say there is no such a thing and to throw away it all away. And it was one of the triumphs, in fact, of Lorentz to find out where it came from, that it was the action of the electron on itself. We therefore must believe in the idea of the action of the electron on itself. So we need this term, and the problem is, how can we get this term without getting that term? And we don't know how. And so, do you see, the classic electron theory has pushed itself into a tight corner. There have been a number of attempts to modify the laws in order to straighten the thing out. The one of which I just mentioned was to forget about the action of an electron on itself. That has the trouble of getting rid of this term. Several different possible things have been made to save the day. One way that was proposed by Born and Infeld is to change the Maxwell equations in the first place so that they're no longer linear in a complicated way, the result being that the total energy in the field comes out finite and the momentum comes out finite instead of infinite, and the charge has a finite energy and momentum. But that changes the laws of Maxwell, predicts other phenomena which have never been observed, and suffers from another difficulty which I'll mention, which all of them suffer from, which I'll mention in a moment when I come to the end of the discussion of the different possibilities. Another possibility suggested by Dirac is this peculiar one. It's a sort of hocus pocus. He says, I admit that that electron does not act on itself except in this way. In order to get rid of this without getting rid of this, he's very ingenious. He says, look, we used to use all the time the retarded waves in the solution. Suppose I use the advanced waves in making this calculation. What difference does it make? Well, it turns out it is not hard to see that it's equivalent to changing the sign of the delays and so on, and changing the sign of the time is equivalent here. And it turns out that if you used advanced potentials instead of retarded potentials, you get this term the same, but this term with the opposite sign, this term the same, the next term with the opposite sign, and so on. So he says, okay, new rule. An electron does not act on itself by the total field that it produces, but only that part which is the difference between what you get calculating by retarded method potentials and the part that's calculated by advanced potentials, the only part I allow in. Then divided by two. You take half the retarded minus half the advanced, and that's the thing. And so you get this minus this, that cancels this term, and gets this, and how about the higher ones over here? Well, they involve A in the numerator, and then I can take, he says, the limit of a point charge. So therefore, he gets the radiation resistance force and none of the inertial forces. There's no electromagnetic mass. And it saves the classical theory at a somewhat of an expense in the arbitrariness of the laws of force. This arbitrariness in the laws of force was somewhat removed, to some extent at least, in a theory by Professor Wheeler and myself, who proposed still a weirder idea, and that was that all charges only interact with each other, and they do so through half advanced and half retarded solution, not by the retarded wave. And then it turns out, most surprisingly, that in most situations, or in many situations, you won't see any of the advanced effects. And furthermore, the net result is to produce just a radiation resistance term that has a funny origin. The force is not due to the electron acting on itself, it's nutty. But that this, when an electron here is accelerated, it shakes electrons in the wall in the past because of the advanced waves. And they act back on here, it shakes the electrons in the future. And they act back on here through the advanced waves, and it's the action of the electrons in the absorbers that act back on here that produce it. Well, you see that there are some kind of tight knots which people have gone into to try to straighten it out. I might show you still another kind of a theory to show the possibilities of things that people think of when they're stuck. And this is another modification of the laws of electrodynamics, particularly proposed by Bopp, I believe, a guy by the name of Bopp, believe it or not. One can change all the laws anywhere you want. You see, you can change the force law on an electron. You can try to change the Maxwell equation. We talked about those two cases. Or you can try to say, forget the Maxwell equation. We only care about the solutions. And one of the formulas is that the vector potential of four dimensions, if you want, is equal to, you remember, the charge density at a position at time t2 and at a place r2. But this was at a delayed time, and you divide by the radial distance and so on. Now, this modification is a beautiful thing. Listen to this one. Suppose that the potential at one point depends upon the charge density at another point. This is potential at this point depends on the charge density at another point, and depends on it in this way, that it depends on only how far apart the points are. So we put in here some function of the distance between the two points, and then integrate over all volumes and all times to get the total potential here. That's all. No equation, no differential equations, nothing. Oh, well, wait. First of all, it has to be relativistically invariant. Therefore, what I mean by the distance must be an invariant distance, and we could take it to be either sign you want, but t1 minus t2 squared minus the actual physical three-dimensional distance squared. You must have a four-dimensionally satisfactory theory. So that's what's meant in here. What about the function f? We'd only assume one thing about the function f. We don't know it yet, but we suppose that if we plot the function f, that it's only important when it's near zero. In other words, only when the distance in the four-dimensional sense between these 0.2 and 1 is very small is there any action. We suppose that the function f has some mean. It isn't something that oscillates to zero. And it has a narrow width. Let's say that the width of the function is more or less an amount of the order which I call a square. I call it a distance squared because of the dimensions, all right? That means that the point one, if you're calculating the potential at the point one, only those places two produce appreciable effect in calculating this if t1 minus t2 square minus r12 square is within plus or minus a squared, very crudely. You can make it more mathematical, but that's the idea. If it's beyond this, it's not important. But now let us suppose that the a is physically very small, and that in all the practical cases, the point one where we want to calculate the potential, like in for motors and generators and so on, is far away from two relative to a, that we're far than compared to the diameter of the electron or the diameter of this formula. Now this, then we can write this way. T1 minus T2 square is equal to R12 square plus or minus A square. In other words, taking the square root, T1, T2, I take the square root the other way, let's say, is equal to T1 plus or minus. You have two roots, but we won't worry about that now. We'll say the positive root. So this is the time that's important. Now, this R1 is very big compared to the A. So I can continue to approximate. I approximate this by writing it. Well, I don't know if you know how to do this fast, but I do still. R12 times the square root of 1 plus A squared over R12 squared, no doubt, right? And the square root of 1 plus a small amount is 1 plus a half of that. So we get plus or minus, actually, A squared over 2R12. Now, what's the significance? It says that the only times that are important, T2, in this integral, are those times which differ from the original time by the delay, R12, and the error for long-distance infinitesimal. See, in other words, this theory approaches the Maxwell theory as long as we're far away from the charge, in the sense, at least, that the only times in this integral that are important are those that are equal to this. And how much actually they are important, they only exist over this range. In other words, when we integrate the dt2, the range of dt2, that this is approximately then equal. First, to the current at the time t1 minus r12 at the time 2, and then the dv2. But then when I integrate dt2, it only gives a contribution over this range. And so the integral of dt2 with delta t2 is this size. So it's some constant, a squared over 2, more or less, times r12. Of course, there can always be a constant in front of this thing. And you can adjust k, a squared, and 2, and so on, to be the charge. So you see, here's back the formula for the retarded potentials, including the 1 over r12, which we worked so hard to get from differential equations, and it turns out it's so easy to get from the simple proposition that the potential at one point depends upon the charge density at another point in space-time times some narrow function of the four-dimensional distance between the two points. This theory, again, predicts a finite mass for the electron, electromagnetic mass, and finite momentum, and this is completely satisfactory with regard to the it turns out the energy and mass vary with velocity, and the energy and mass are the right relations for the relativity theory, of course, because it's relativistically invariant, and everything would be otherwise all right. But there's one fundamental objection to all of the theories, and that is this. In the meantime, quantum mechanics was developed, and the quantum mechanical modification of electrodynamics has to be made, has to be made. Electrons behave as, light behaves as photons, not by. It's different. It doesn't 100% like the Maxwell theory. So the electrodynamics theory has to be changed. In fact, one might say it's a sort of a waste of time to work so hard to straighten this out, because it might turn out that in the quantum theory of electrodynamics, which is in fact called quantum electrodynamics, the difficulties may disappear, may be resolved in some other fashion. Turns out, first, that the difficulties in quantum electrodynamics do not disappear. That is one of the reasons why people have spent so much effort trying to straighten out the classical difficulty, thinking that if they could straighten out the classical difficulty and then make the quantum theory of the straightened out thing, everything would be straightened out. Because the old theory still has the difficulties after quantum mechanics' modifications are made. Well, it turns out, however, that nobody has made a consistent quantum theory of any of the modified theories. That is, the theory with the non-Maxwell equations of Born and Infeld have never been satisfactorily made into a quantum theory. The theory with advanced and retarded waves of Dirac or Wheeler and Feynman has never been made into a satisfactory quantum theory. This theory of Bopp has never been made into a satisfactory quantum theory, and so on. And today, there is no solution to this problem known. We do not know how to have a consistent theory, including the quantum mechanics, which does not produce an infinity for the self-energy of an electron or a point charge. And at the same time, there's no theory that describes a non-point charge satisfactorily. So we haven't solved it. I must immediately remark that the formulas which appear here for the electromagnetic mass in terms of the size of the electron and so on are completely modified. The quantum electrodynamics does change the formula for the mass, but it also has in it, comes out infinity. And unless you stop the integrations, just like we stopped the integration on the radius. See, if you stop the integrations which are involved in the quantum dynamics somewhere, then you get a formula that depends upon how you stop the integration, and it isn't exactly the same as it involves Planck's constant and so on here and there. But it turns out, it does turn out to be infinite if you take a point charge. I'm sorry that I can't demonstrate in the quantum theory now that we're going to get the same difficulty, of course, because we haven't developed quantum theory at all, hardly at all, much less the quantum theory of electrodynamics. On the other hand, I would warn you immediately if you're deciding to rush out of here to make a theory which, in which the self-action, the action of electron itself is completely removed, and that electromagnetic mass is no longer meaningful, and that you will decide someday to make a quantum theory of it, that this is bound to have its difficulties, because there is definite experimental evidence of the existence of electromagnetic inertia. In other words, there is evidence that some of the mass of a particle is electromagnetic in origin. Now, where does the evidence come from? If nature were to present us with two objects, one neutral and the other charged, which are otherwise known to be the same, then by looking at the observed mass of the charged one and the observed mass of the neutral one and comparing them, we could see whether there was any electromagnetic mass. It used to be said, if you look in an older book, since nature will definitely, obviously not present us with two particles, one of which is neutral and the other which is charged, which we know is otherwise the same, we can't verify how much of the mass is electromagnetic and how much is mechanical. But it turns out that she has been so kind as to present us with just such a thing. Examples. We have neutrons and protons. They interact with tremendous forces, nuclear forces, origin unknown. However, we've already discussed the fact that the nuclear forces have one remarkable property. As far as they're concerned, the neutron and proton are exactly the same. All the forces between neutron and neutron, neutron and proton, proton and proton are the same, as long as it's nuclear force, but only the little electromagnetic forces are different. So that's our example. Of course, electrically, the proton-neutron is different as night and day, but from the point of view of the strong interactions, what we call the strong interaction, nuclear forces, these are the same. And they have a difference in mass, a small difference in mass. I've written here a table of a number of the pairs of particles, neutrals, and charge, which we believe are otherwise the same except for their electrical properties. And you'll find them among the list, the proton and neutron. And here is the mass written in million electron volts per particle, and million electron volts. The mass of an electron in this scale is 0.511 million electron volts. The difference between the proton and the neutron mass does definitely exist. There's a small difference of -1.3. So the electromagnetic mass of a proton exceeds that of a neutron by -1.3 MeV, or about 2.6 electrons. If the classical theory were correct, this would mean that the radius A, of the thing that's doing it is of the general order of magnitude of 1/3 or 1/4 of this, say, which is in the neighborhood of 10^-13 centimeters. The other mass differences are somewhat larger, and the indication from the classical theory is that things break down near 10^-14 centimeters. But you cannot trust the classical theory here. You must use the quantum formulas. And by an accident that I do not understand, it's a combination of two pi's and God knows what, the orders of magnitude of the places where you make the cutoff is exactly the same in the quantum theory. So it's just about the size of the charge distributions that are involved here. It turns out that beside neutron and proton in the world, there are other particles. For example, if we collide two protons together, we can produce a neutron, a proton, and a pi plus. One of the protons you can think of, it doesn't make any difference just for the sake of discussion, as being only to supply the momentum and energy, and it is often easier to write reactions like this without that, which just describe the possibilities, you should say, plus or minus energy from some source, you see. It just tells what's coupled to what. So let me shorten the equations by telling you what's coupled to what. through strong interactions without the other particles which are involved. Now, that's one. But because protons and neutrons have to be absolutely symmetrical, and everything that happens to one has to be able to be replaced, you'll be able to replace in every equation one by another, there must be another object in here. And there is. There's a neutral object. So that every equation that you could write in which you would, for strong interactions, in which you would interchange protons and neutrons, there always should be possible to write a corresponding reaction. So we have to have more than one pi meson, so-called charge, pluses, neutrals, and minuses. And here the plus and minus are both the same mass of 139.6, but the neutral is a little bit different in mass, and we can believe that this difference in mass is purely electromagnetic. This is 4.6 MeV, or 10 times the mass of an electron, and that's where I get the idea. It's in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 times 10 to the minus 14 centimeters, but as I said before, that's just luck. The quantum theory gives the same result. I needn't go into further examples. There are other particles that are coupled with proton and neutron, K mesons, and there is another example, and sigma mesons, and there are other examples. You notice that the mass differences are all of the generally the same order of magnitude. They turn out to be just of the order of magnitude that you would expect from the theory. How can you say that? It's infinite. Yeah, I know, but if you stop the integrals at a place that's more or less the size of these particles as determined by other methods, then you get this sort of magnitude. So then it does look like this is due solely to electromagnetic energy, and that these differences in masses represent electromagnetic mass. You will be worried, no doubt, by the various signs. It was easy to believe that the charged ones are heavier than the neutrals, but how does it come out in the case of proton and neutron that it's the other way and in other cases? Turns out the situation for more complicated particles than an electron is quite more elaborate. You see, from the fact that a charged object is neutral, you can't tell exactly what the charge distribution is. For instance, suppose that there was an object which had a proton on the inside and a pi minus meson cloud around it, for instance. Suppose that's a neutron. It's a neutral object. Or suppose that a neutron part of the time looks like this. Then there are electrical forces and energies. And so it's not so easy to tell what the sign is, because all of these particles have roots into states which have charges involved, and so their electromagnetic energies are more complicated than what you'd get for a point object. But the thing that I'd like to emphasize is first, that the electromagnetic theory predicts the existence of electromagnetic mass, but also falls on its face in doing so, for it cannot produce a consistent theory of it. That the quantum modifications continue to suggest the existence of electromagnetic mass, but that the theory is impossible of, we have not at the present time a consistent theory of this. Finally, that there is experimental evidence for electromagnetic masses, and here we have some listed. And at last, since these masses are all of the order of the mass of an electron, we turn back again to the original idea of Lorentz. Maybe all of the mass of an electron is purely electromagnetic. Maybe the whole value of 0.511 is all due to electrodynamics. Is it or isn't it? We cannot calculate. We haven't got a theory, so we cannot say. On the other hand, there's one piece of evidence which is the most annoying. There's another particle in the world which, as far as we can tell, differs in no way whatsoever from an electron. Well, how do we know it's another particle? Except for one property. And that's called a muon. And the difference is, in every way, it acts like an electron. It interacts with neutrinos. It does everything exactly the same, with one difference. And that is that its mass is 206.77 times an electron. Now, this object interacts with nothing else, does nothing different than an electron. It interacts with electromagnetic field the same way, everything the same way. Its mass is different. Therefore, whatever it is, when you finally get the explanation of the mass of an electron, you have then the puzzle of, where does the muon get its mass, because it interacts with nothing else than the mass of the electron does. So whatever the electron does, the mu ought to do, and the mass ought to come out the same. There are those who we believe so faithfully in this idea, who believe that it'll turn out that when we finally get the consistent theory of the mass, the formula for the mass will be a quadratic equation with two roots. There are also those who propose it'll be a transcendental equation with an infinite number of roots, and are now engaged in guessing where the other particle is that's still higher mass.
Finally, I would like to make some remark about the other part of the mass. It's all very well to say, part of it's electromagnetic, what's the rest of it? There are other forces besides electrodynamics. There are nuclear forces, meson forces, so forth. And they have their own field theory.
Theory?
Nobody knows if the theory's right. And according to those theories, there will be masses associated with those particles analogous to electromagnetic mass. You can call it pi mesic field mass, you know, which is presumably very large because the forces are great, and that is a possible origin of the rest of it. But since we're so impossibly difficult to get the first base with the electrodynamics, that you strike out with the theory of the mesons. May I have just one moment to outline the way the theory of the mesons goes, because it's interesting connection to electrodynamics. In electrodynamics, the photons are described by the equation A mu, the balanciation of A mu equals the source. And this seems like the only possible theory for a particle's relativistically invariant. Okay, give me 2 minutes and I'll tell you something interesting. Now, in order to make a corresponding theory of nuclei, people notice that in the same way, if an electron hits another electron, it might emit a photon. They make this equation analogous to this one. And the photons, which are satisfy the wave equation, this equals zero, are replaced by pions, which will satisfy a corresponding wave equation for some other quantity like this. By analogy. The reason they make analogies is because the human brain is so weak, it can't think of anything really new, so it tries to make as close an analogy as possible. But it finds out when it's making this analogy several things. First of all, what is this? Could this be a four-vector, or is it a scalar? Or what kind of a quantity is it in four-dimensional notations, a vector or a scalar? It turns out from studying the pion that it's shown to be a scalar. So that's one difference. Secondly, this would produce forces just like in electrodynamics, which vary inversely as the radius. But nuclear forces don't go out that far, so this is wrong. But keeping the relativistic invariance is not destroyed by writing here some constant times phi equals zero instead. So the proposal was made by Yukawa that the forces of nuclei are determined by an equation of this type. Let's just look just one moment at the force. If things are not changing with time, what kind of solutions we get for the free waves from a point source? Well, we have to solve this equation from a point source instead of the equation without the mu squared. And you remember for radial forces, this is 1 over r times the second derivative with respect to r of r phi minus mu squared phi equals 0. And finally, it comes out, then if you solve this thing by multiplying by r, that r phi is e to the minus mu r, and that the potentials of nuclear forces, instead of being 1 over r, are e to the minus mu r over r. In other words, they die off exponentially within a certain distance. And this distance, then, is the range of nuclear forces, which is very much smaller than electrodynamics. Finally, if you look at the free waves here, instead of the free waves here, in these things you have omega squared minus k squared c squared equals 0, the relation between frequency and wave number. In here, you have omega squared minus k squared c squared minus mu squared equals 0, and relating energy to frequency and wave number to momentum in a way that we discussed previously, you'll see that this says that this particle has a mass mu times, I think, Planck's constant over the speed of light or something like that. So that the object should have a rest mass that corresponds to the mu, unlike the gamma, and the rest mass of the pi is of the right order for the known range of the forces. I illustrate this to show you that the electrodynamics has been pushed into regions where presumably it may not really be valid in order to explain nuclear forces. And that's the end of all of the theory that I can give you on this subject. Some of them have and some of them don't have a symmetry. The sigmas exist in a different
condition. There's a particle called a lambda, which is neutral, which we haven't talked about. But the neutron can go into a lambda and a K. And the proton has to go also into a lambda, and it can also go.
It therefore must be two Ks, and these are the two Ks.
But now there's also the sigma, and there are three kinds. So the neutron can go into a sigma, and let's say K plus. Then the proton, now this is getting a little bit elaborate. Let me try to give a quicker, or let me just work with the K to show you that there's something. I'm sorry, it will make it get too long. It turns out that the equations among the sigmas are symmetrical as far as neutrons and protons and Ks and so on are concerned, but they're not symmetrical with respect to charges. For example, I can't make a quick explanation. It turns out that these various particles, when they are coupled, although they're coupled symmetrically with protons, neutrons, and Ks, as they should be, they're not coupled so that every combination of charge is equally allowed. Because you see, it starts with a lopsidedness. Neutron, proton is not plus half, minus a half, but is zero and one. And that knocks everything off by a half a unit. So that the things are all not symmetrical electrically. See, if the neutron had been negative a half a unit of electric charge, and the proton plus half a unit of electric charge, then that symmetry would be maintained. But it's as though you were to add the proton-neutron already a little unsymmetrical, because one is one and the other is zero electrically. And that is reflex. That's the best way to describe it. That just gets into this, and it changes the electrical properties. It's rather hard to explain without telling you too much.
Having a positive charge gives it a different charge.
No. It has to do with what this can turn into. And it's because when it turns one way, it goes into proton, while the other one will go in the corresponding case into a neutron. And those are not symmetrical. It's not clear. I didn't explain it clearly. If you follow me, you're a genius. But it's related to that. And you'd have just to look at the theory of the particles to see. It's a rather subtle point. These two are symmetrical because one is the antiparticle of the other. It's a little hard. It's a little advanced to explain. I can't explain it very well. It's the main reason for the asymmetry in the beginning is that the proton and neutron are not electrically symmetrical. They are from nuclear force symmetrical, but electrically they're not. One is one and the other is zero, not plus and minus a half. And that asymmetry is set into all of the particles which can disintegrate into proton and neutron.
How does the theory of a virtual process fit into all this picture?
Well, the virtual process is the difference between this. You see, you notice that when I compute the Coulomb law, I get a force that has nothing to do with real waves running around, free waves. But from the same equations, with time variations, I get free waves. So those are real photons, okay? Well, there's not a consistent theory that just has the photons and doesn't have the corresponding Coulomb law forces and so on, which goes with it. They must go together, the equations have the one set of equations produces both the photons and the forces. When they're talking about the forces and talking in the quantum mechanical language, they try to remind you that those forces are associated with the field which, if it shook free, would be a photon. So they say it's like a photon, or they call it a virtual photon, not a real photon. So they say the Coulomb law is produced by virtual photons in a field in which, if you shake it fast enough, the real waves are honest photons. It's an identification. And so in the same sense, what we're saying here, that the nuclear forces were due to virtual mesons, which when you had enough energy, become free as a free particle, which is a real meson. That is, the meson, it's something like this. The meson, pi meson, is to nuclear force is as the photon is to Coulomb force, the Coulomb electrical force, electrostatic force. whatever the hell that is, that quantitative ratio, you know what I mean? This is to this, like that is to that. And I tried to write an equation from which, on the one hand, I got the Coulomb force, namely this thing. And on the other hand, I got the free waves. And then I took the modified equation for meson theory and showed first, if you're looking for the force, you get the nuclear force. And then if you look at the free waves, you get a particle with a mass. That's what I was trying to do. But I was so rushed at the end, I didn't do it very well. It's just a way of referring to this ratio. It's to say the Coulomb force is due to virtual photons. It's a language which refers to the connection between the Coulomb force and the photon.
So that really isn't a theory that really explains anything. I mean, it doesn't...
No, it describes it. Those words describe a theory. Yes, the theory does explain something. If I were to say, if I were to use a new word, and I could have said that the Coulomb force is due to virtual light.
I see.
It's not free light that rides around free, but it's connected to light, because light is the electromagnetic wave, and it's all part of the great field, which, at the bottom level, has to make the forces, you see. So we would say that the light, that electromagnetic force is virtual light. Technically, it is true also that the word virtual photon has some meaning in the perturbation quantum mechanics. But it's better not to worry about that, because the real meaning in the sentences you were using it at, since you weren't calculating anything, is just what I just said, that those are related and that. It's only mathematics. You see, if you have a single theory, then perfectly clearly sometimes it's going to describe photons. And in another case, in another part of the formula, it'll be describing forces, right? But there'll be some ghost left of the photon quality, and you call that the analysis through virtual photons. That's all. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I've got the generalization you were interested in.
For the nucleon.
Yeah.
Good.
Their pressure. Their pressure is in there now. Isn't that what you want?
Oh, that's one more thing I wanted in there. But I wanted more interesting was the. The degenerate.
No, they're not degenerate.
Oh,
but,
all right.
But I've got the continuum. We were talking about, remember, so now you can go the whole way from ordinary stuff.
Dogs, right.
The whole way up to these things.
Okay, and see what happens there. Also, I've gotten in the meantime quite interested in the. I'll talk to you.
All right, when I just thought I'd mention.
I can't talk to you today, but I'll talk to you Tuesday.
Okay. Dick, I want you to meet.
Yes, we've met.
Oh, I see. You know, she's a guest used to writing an article for Realité.
No, I don't read it from time to time, but I know the magazine.